Welcome to the Great Security Debate with Dan Ayala, Eric Willey, and Brian Schneebly, and today's special guest, Forrester analyst Jess Byrne. This show has experts taking sides to broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress. So I've got this report. Forrester this week released and we've talked a lot about Forrester reports over the past few episodes. There's a great report on top recommendations for your security program in 2021. As I'm reading through this, it's got a really good set of set of things, places to put your head. And I know I sent it to you, Eric and Brian, things to think about this year. And one that came to mind, I think we're dealing with it a lot, is around tech consolidation. As we're seeing all of these tech the acquisitions, I mean, it's been a monster set of months for acquisition, not just in tech, not just in security, but in tech as a whole. And where once we had, viewed a technology acquisition through, technology purchase through the lens of a small organization, or an organization we had, insight into and a little more direct control in some cases, offset with some additional risk because they're smaller organizations. Now they're getting, subsumed by large organizations where it's a lot more opaque. Terms and conditions get changed, privacy policies get changed, and the creation of these monster aggregation and single platforms to do lots of things has come together. And I don't know about you, I just continue to get I'm not quite there. We're back 20 years on the best of breed versus versus the suite discussion. It's it's Lotus Notes all over again. And I vowed I wouldn't work in places with Lotus Notes ever again. So where we're at, you guys, what do you guys think on tech consolidation and and then making the decision to pull something out because it's either not good enough or you just or your organization bought a big suite and says, guess what? It has a security feature. You get to use it at no additional cost, but it's not good enough.
Yeah, the conversation around this is so nuanced. And the one thing I will say, if we look at the consolidators, so the big security companies that are buying up the little products and bolting them in, I think the landscape, at least from my perspective, has gotten better. Because I think historically, if we go back, if you look at, there's probably a couple big names that we could throw out that we'd go, that's where good companies go to die, right? That once they get bought up, there's no R&D put into it. They never actually get fully integrated. Now, I think most companies are starting to change that. I'll call it even Cisco has gotten better at this, Proofpoint of the world, and certainly kind of providing a bigger ecosystem where the sum of the parts is greater. Did I mess up the phrase? Pretty sure I did. But what they're creating as a consolidated platform has gotten better. I'll tell you though, my biggest concern, and this kind of harkens back, if you have the cloud conversation, everybody's got a journey to the cloud. And it's the, am I going single source cloud or am I going with a multi-cloud? Because let's look at Microsoft that has taken some pretty substantial outages recently as it pertains to Azure Active Directory, which is kind of the underpinning with a lot of what they do. If that goes down, you're talking about a whole enterprise architecture that could do the same thing. So pivot it back to a security tool that if you've got all your tools that are all plugged into this one vendor, you run that risk that if they do take the outage, now granted companies are getting better at HA resiliency and all those things, but you're putting a lot of eggs in one single basket.
Right. We've been calling it concentration risk at Forrester. So we're, putting all your executives on one plane should they ever fly on a plane again, and there's a benefit to platforms, obviously, but there's also a benefit to a point solution, that really works for your company. So what we said in the 2021 priorities doc was think about what you can accept as good enough, because sometimes that good enough is not good enough for your organization. And think about where you really need to fight for as a security leader, that best of breed product. I mean, I've spoken with a lot of CISOs over, especially in the back half of last year, that said, you know, I've got the CFO and the CIO coming to me with an offer that they couldn't refuse for, you know, and now I've got to get rid of, you know, my EDR that I really like, you know, or my some sort of endpoint solution, and I don't want to, and I need to fight for it. And I think it's important. You have to make that decision based on your organization and not just sort of roll over and take a good enough solution if that's not going to work.
Wait, Eric, Brian, who's that? Did somebody Zoom bomb us?
We just got Zoom bombed. I think we have somebody else. Who's the new voice that just
joined? Oh my goodness. It's Jess Byrne, one of the authors of this document that we're talking about, this research report from Forrester.
Wow.
Forrester. Jess, welcome.
Thanks for letting me Zoom bomb you.
Hey, no problem. I guess is it still Zoom bombing if we sent you the link in the passcode?
No, probably not. So we'll call it a guest appearance, I guess.
Yes.
There we go.
So just so everybody knows, Jess Byrne is a
senior analyst at Forrester.
And one of the authors of this document. And if you're interested in a link to the document, look in the show notes. So welcome, Jess. We'll just continue on the conversation. And we're really glad to have you here to talk about this.
Welcome.
And I'm going to do the first pivot into using an automotive analogy. So when you were talking about that, like best of breed suppliers, when you look at, and this goes back to security, right? It was when some people say, well, what are, like, you know, if you said safety critical points, right? So in a vehicle, over 50% of all safety critical items are located in the seat structure. Okay. And we call those, like, whether you want to call them Delta S's, et cetera. Most people are like, really? Yeah. If you get into an accident, right, that structure being tied down to the floor, the frame, how that thing bends, the transport of energy, the statics, and the airbag systems, everything. There's over 50% of all the safety critical items for a collision located there. So if you think about your infrastructure, the enterprise security, if there was an area where you said, where are all 50% or more of, you know, my Delta S or safety critical items located, you know, if I'm buying 100 tools, which ones handle the criticality, the high level? There was an OE, which original equipment manufacturer, and that stands for the Fords, the GMs, et cetera, of the world, that decided when they were sourcing the seat that they would go ahead and take the seat structure and break down every single component and then source them all individually because they thought they could save a few dollars rather than finding a seat manufacturer, because there's only so many seat manufacturers out there. And this comes down to the welds and everything else when building that structure up. What they found later, which occurred almost 2.5 years down the pipeline of development, was that you give all those components to a seat manufacturer to assemble, and they start to complain that there's issues with crash testing, et cetera, and that you own it as the OE because you forced us to use these suppliers. I look at that as when a technology company has a very large stack and goes to the very top, a CTO or a CIO, and says, look it, you can use all these components, right? And then they take that to the seat manufacturer, the CISO, who's handling all the safety critical items, and says, here, now you assemble it. Okay, well, the warranty then lies with you, Mr. CIO and CTO, because you handpicked this company to go ahead and make bolts, widgets, et cetera, that we then have to weld together. And they're doing it with, when you talk about plus or minus 0.01, those tolerances after stacking up mean that we're off by 3. And when that happens, people die.
You're with a vendor. I speak for CISOs when I say I don't think they appreciate all the end runs that are happening around them when it comes to things like these larger tech consolidation plays. Like, when is it appropriate to go up the food chain a little higher to make a case? I mean, I feel like it's happening too much right now, and the CISOs are trying to keep up, and then they have to make a case for keeping what they already put in place that's working and they were comfortable with.
Right. And some pretty aggressive end arounds. It's not just oh, by the way, you can get these things. There's active spreadsheets that say that, you know, that are they're almost undermining, asking CIOs to undermine their own CISO or start to question their own CISO and the approaches that have been taken. Now, I want to be clear. There are places where these suites were good enough is good enough.
Right.
We do not need to be the world of cobbling together all of the best of breed, because for the same reasons that Brian just mentioned, you know, I cobble enough things together, unless I've got a ridiculously large security or development engineering staff, it's going to cost us way more in time and effort to build and maintain those. You know, some of the reasons people love Amazon, very great, very powerful tools, but they don't just run out of the box. You have to develop to Amazon Web Services.
Right.
And if you're not prepared to do that, you may put yourself into a false sense of security. But I don't know about you, but when these things happen, it has brand impact on me. You know, I think differently about the types of organizations that try those end arounds. And maybe there is a good product to buy, but I'm going to be predisposed against that because of that habit. You know, there's life to those.
Yeah. We got to kind of tease it apart, because I think we're talking about two different things here, right? You're talking about the sales cycle and who they're pitching to. Because I agree. That becomes a problem. That erodes trust. Mm-hmm. If you skip over me and jump over to our CIO or jump further up the chain, if you get a relationship with a CEO or something like that, now granted, it all depends, right? Because I've seen it where the CEO and the president of this company are already good friends, and it was just a conversation. Totally get that.
And that's not that's not a new dynamic.
No, not at all. But certainly that erodes trust. If it gets pushed down to me and the decision gets taken out of kind of my realm, that becomes kind of problematic. But you know, I think as we look at and look at just the consolidation and single platform for some of these tools, it really draws back to understanding what matters most for the business and what are the core competencies of the team, right? Mm-hmm. Dan, you started to allude to this, that depending on the size of the team, what you can cobble together. But let's be honest, there are teams out there that are smaller security teams where they can highly benefit from a very consolidated platform.
Sure.
That can do more than the parts that they could individually buy. It becomes more cost effective. Mm-hmm. Now, for the bigger organizations, probably not there, depending on the organizational needs. And that's really comes back to leadership and understanding, you know, if you call it the crown jewels or whatever, what do you really need? And Jess, I think you did a great job of kind of calling attention to this. You have to understand what you actually need to understand, can you do good enough or do you need more? What matters most?
But I agree with everything you said. There's one point I want to make though, in as you know, you buy for what you need, but you should also be thinking about buying for what you will need.
Sure.
A little bit. And the problem with a lot of the, you know, back, and this is where I think the sales approach and the engineering approach actually come together, is that they're being engineered with lock-in in mind. They're not, I mean, it's a good sales tactic, but they're, you know, the amount of interoperability that exists in some of these larger technology areas where they're building security in is, It feels to me like it's designed to make sure that I can't go to third parties. And I understand that's part of selling, but it also is something I take into account, even with smaller clients that need these things, as to whether or not, as to whether or not we can, we go down that road, even if it might be right for now, they might never be able to break out of it. At the next step or, you know, two steps beyond, because of that kind of lock-in. And I do try and keep that in mind.
One thing I was going to put out there too, and I think this goes to the conversation around multi-cloud environment, right? When you look at the value that one cloud environment brings over another, there's reasons why very large enterprises would want to have a multi-cloud environment. In that conversation from, whether it's CIO, CTO, in allowing you to use, if you want to call it best of breed, for the use cases that you have in the different verticals of your business. You know, there's verticals of businesses, and then there's verticals of your own business, right? Things that you're doing internally. So there's reasons why you would want to have that multi-cloud environment. And then from there, the decision becomes, instead of using the built-in tools for each one of those, there's certain overlays where if you're looking from how do I protect this, why you would want to pick a tool that allows you to manage certain points of security for those, right? Same thing from a supply base in the manufacturing setting.
Let me ask this, because I know at one point there was a thought pattern around, if you look at some of the bigger consolidators, bigger players, that if I'm on your platform, so we'll just, because Microsoft, well, you know, if I'm on Windows as an organization, why would I pay you more and trust you that your security tool is now going to protect the platform that I'm running the business on? Like, shouldn't that be ingrained? Is that still a thing that we're still concerned about Microsoft protecting itself?
That they are capable or are not capable?
Yes.
and that they applies to any vendor. That's not just right. Talking about Microsoft.
They're just the,
I guess, yeah. is your concern, is the comment you're saying that we can,
are we past that?
And should?
Are we past that? Because I know I can look back and I know I have uttered the words that I wouldn't trust, and this is historically, trust Microsoft to protect themselves. That if you really were invested in protecting yourselves, you'd build the controls on the front end and wouldn't see as many vulnerabilities. So why would I pay you extra for a security tool to then bolt on and fix problems you created in the first place?
Wait, now they've done that and we're complaining about it.
Well, I think it also comes down, and again, this is using automotive as an example, just because you build the seat, the ECU that goes into it, should you also build the ECU? You weren't even a electronics supplier before, but now you're building ECUs and putting them into the seat just because it was easier to manufacture in this location and save money on logistics. And now you make a sunroof, so we're going to have you make the ECU for that. And anything power, we're going to have you make the ECU for, but you weren't doing it before. But as you get better on it, we're okay, even though that there's problems with it. It's kind of the analogy of when you say Microsoft, you use all these tools, you purchase these components, use them in the organization. Now when security starts to become more of a risk, a need, now they're putting more energy towards it. But do you still accept that they're the best to be protecting those other tools that you're buying, I think is what you were alluding to.
Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I think there's this, is it good enough or do you need something else? I think it all comes down to what you need. I think platform plays like AWS have done tremendous things, to earlier point, but for small and medium-sized businesses, fantastic. They couldn't have gotten that from cobbling together point solutions. But I think as you get larger and larger, I mean, you need to think about what makes the most sense for your environment. I mean, again, I hate to see people in positions where they're trying to fight for something that works. Now, of course, consolidation also means eliminating waste, right? If you've been through rounds of mergers and acquisitions, yes, clean up, you know, obviously, but don't get rid of something that actually is working, that you have people that know how to use it and you're actually getting real value from it. That's where you have to make the decision and fight for it. And I feel for folks that are kind of on the other end of this. I think security has had the benefit of an open wallet for a really long time, and last year sort of slammed shut. And although I think security budget has not been affected in the way other parts of the IT organization has been, there were still some pains here and there felt, you know, because budget went out the window to shore up the work from home environment too. So now this is one of the reasons why we did this report was, you know, okay, you made some emergency purchases last year. You did some, you might've gotten lax on some processes because of emergency. You might've changed your policies, or you may need to write whole new policies. 2021 should be about stepping back for a second, figuring out, all right, what did I do last year that I'm good with? What do I need to fix right now? And then what does this mean for 2022? And beyond. So that's how we tried to frame all seven of these recommendations. So, you know, again, we'll at least get the link to the blog in the show notes that is not behind the paywall for everybody.
Hey, Jess, I think this is a good pivot though, mm-hmm. because one of the things you just talked about, you know, merger acquisitions, and especially 2020, taking inventory, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Knowing what you have, knowing what you're using, knowing what works. You know, why that's important to take inventory.
Absolutely.
Right. And I think that also helps when managing budget as well. Like, where are we spending the most money internally and why? You know, that was the best of breed product 3 years ago. There was a reason we paid a premium for it. But today there's a lot of people in that space.
Yep.
It's become more competitive. Just simply, and it's not that you have to make a project, but just simply by putting out, let's say, an RFI would force that vendor to come to the table and say, am I still the best of breed? And can I still demand that price, right? There needs to be some level set. And you see that in manufacturing, right? Whether it's the shoe industry, the car industry, the security industry. But I'll let you guys run with that. I just wanted to kind of pivot to that real quick because you mentioned it, Jess.
Well, it sounds like you're getting into kind of continual evaluation, right? And it's, we've talked about that in security controls in general, that once something's in place, that you can't just, all right, check the box, it's done, I'll never look at that again, right? It's the Kaizen approach that we're continually improving, that we're continually, and Kaizen, not Kaizen. That's, which
you'd
is
like that discussion. You can go back three episodes or two episodes.
Cooking the books. But certainly, you know, I think Brian, I think that that's very pertinent, that where we are today is not where we're going to be tomorrow. And we've got to continually reevaluate the spaces we're in, because the, our space changes so rapidly. And if you look at the tools that are relevant today, may not be relevant tomorrow. We've got to make sure that, that we're on that. But a lot of that really does come back to understanding what matters most and focusing on that area that, that we're building around the most critical areas of the organization.
But I'll get back on my soapbox and say it's not just about tools either. And that same reevaluation includes process, includes people. And I think tools should be the last part you go to, because, you know, we when the wallet's closed, or when the wallet is when the number can't get any bigger organizationally, you know, it's a great time to go back in and look at your processes. And see how you can make those better and use those to better secure things. Because I promise you, we don't need new tech for everything that we need to do to secure our organizations. So you know, it's a really good time for that. And you know, as we were leading up to this this episode, you know, we were talking also about understanding what you've got, not just from a how we secure it perspective, or you know, the tools and processes we use to secure it, but what do we have as an organization? What's our actual footprint? And I think, you know, Jess, this is one of those areas that as we read this, that felt like we would have loved to have seen this called out, only because I think people lose sight of the fact that what's the first thing an auditor says when they walk in? Give me your inventory.
Yeah.
And we're really bad at this as technology, as companies. So
very bad.
This is my opportunity to remind people, don't get the inventories.
Visibility is dismal. Asset visibility. Absolutely. I hear that over and over and over again. You know, huge perennial problems are asset visibility and vulnerability management. They tie together, you know, very, very well too.
But we can write really good, really long security questionnaires and give them to other people and expect that they've got it. And it's kind of a mismatch too. We expect everyone else that we do business with to be perfect, as we, you know, more and more focus comes on third-party risk management. Right. But looking inward, we should expect the same of ourselves in terms of inventory and vulnerability management and vendor management, and all those things that we expect of our third parties, that we've now focused on making sure our third parties do in light of SolarWinds, but aren't necessarily.
Are you saying we've moved towards do what I say, not as I do?
as a parent of a teenager, I would never say that.
But it's so true. And I feel like this conversation is never going to change. So we have to keep drawing back to foundational items, right? If you don't know about it, you can't protect it. So it doesn't matter what cool blinking lights that you pour into the 100%. Environment. And we got to keep drawing back to that. It's the basics.
One thing I wanted to touch back on, Dan, you mentioned in knowing the company you work for too, right? So you didn't pivot, but to knowing all, like for one of the first questions asked, okay, show me all your assets, show me everything that you have, right? And being able to have an inventory of that. But also I think taking inventory of who you are as a business, right? Knowing when you said, one of the things was secure what you sell and then third party risk. Mm-hmm. So securing what you sell also means who you are as a business. So what is more risk to you? Is it your intellectual property? You know, if you're a manufacturer that's working on next generation electrical drivetrain, right, and powertrain parts, right, that intellectual property is your next, you know, ROI, return on investment for the next 30 years of your organization, right? That is really, really important. Which is different than a company that's not producing a finished good or working on that next generation finished good. So intellectual property could be one. The other one, brand reputation, right? We don't really have a ton of IP intellectual property, but our brand reputation, people come to our platform to buy things, right? Something happens there. That could be really important. So for each one of those businesses, look at what drives our revenue. What's going to drive our revenue in the future, and how do we protect that? Because intellectual property might be one of them versus just a ransomware outbreak, right? Where maybe they got some data, but it wasn't the intellectual property. It was data of, you know, the customers we have, right? And they want to hurt our brand image, and they're trying to erode our consumer base in terms of trusting us. And that goes back to what Eric was saying, the speed of trust. It goes both ways, whether internally or externally. And you right. break that, and you got to build that back.
I'll draw back, and I know we've talked about this before. I think that the core, the number one thing a CISO has got to be able to do is build relationships, right? And I'm going to tie that back in something I saw in the chat, and I think, Brian, that you mentioned about procurement, right? That as we look at consolidated platforms, that is advantageous to procurement departments who their key metric is keeping sure. costs down, right? So that is a key driver. Right. And we are actually, so we were having this conversation on Clubhouse recently on how that can be detrimental to a security program. It was kind of, we talked about here, because procurement then may see that, well, we can get it cheaper and security is security, so we'll dictate it down. But that's where relationships come in and being yes. able to have that conversation. Same thing with the CIO, that if you've got a good relationship with the CIO, when the sales person tries to do the jump, that they should reframe the conversation. Well, I'm going to bring in my risk leader for the same thing with procurement, having that conversation and understanding that from a procurement standpoint, we have the same objective. We want the company to be financially responsible because that is for future growth. But from a risk model, we, as the security practitioner, that's not really a shared model. I mean, it's shared with different business leaders, but not, I don't think it's shared with procurement. So I think that's got to be kind of a mutual understanding that we're working towards the same financial objectives, but the risk objectives, that's something that, you know, us as a security department need to take on. I went a little tangential there.
No, you have to form the, it does come back to relationships. You have to form the relationships that make those folks in procurement or the CIO realize, oh gosh, there's a voice missing from this conversation and I really need to bring that person in. And that doesn't happen all the time. You know, I think it's getting better. But, you know, my colleague Jeff Pollard always touts his book called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And I think that's part of it, right? And I think it's taken a while. We just wrote a report, Jeff and myself and a few of my colleagues on the CISO's first 100 days. And the first thing we recommend is get out there and have those meetings, right? But I'm writing this in something later on, like even if you haven't and you're 10 years into your gig, it's never too late, you know? It might be awkward, get over it and get out there and form those relationships so you can be somebody who's like, oh, where is the CISO? We need that person's voice in this conversation.
Yeah. And that's if anybody who's got, who's a subscriber to Forrester, that's a good one to read as well. I went through that one and I really like drawing attention to it that technology was the last aspect of it.
Yeah.
That it was building the relationships, understanding the program, understanding the people that are at play. And then once you understand all of those aspects, now we can talk technology.
Totally. I love all the Forrester love.
Spot on though, because I think our natural draw, most of us came from a technology background. Yes. We love technology. So that's naturally where we want to jump in first. I mean, I was texting back and forth with Dan and I sent him an answer back in JSON array. I mean, that's kind of our core where we came from.
It's an important realization that the role of the CISO is no longer a technology role. By and large, and there are companies that are still evolving into sure. this, but the future of this role, the future of the security organization has large components of it that are technical, this is a business role.
Yeah, no, I mean, I spent the last 8 years, right, on the Security Risk Council. And Dan, you were a part of this when you were a couple of jobs ago. And you remember that most of the conversations were not about vendor selection, no. right? Sorry, Brian. But they were about, oh God, I have to present to the board, or, you know, I'm trying to get buy-in. What should my strategy look like? How should I align better with the business? What should my metrics look like? Everything that was, you know, we're not going to use the term soft skills anymore for our earlier conversation, but these are communications pieces. These are relationship plays that people need to get better at. And that's what this peer group, you know, is 35, 40 CISOs in a room for the past 8 years. I've been bringing these folks together now virtually for a year, but, you know, they wanted to talk about the business alignment and communications aspect. So yeah, it's a big part of the role.
Right.
Well, and that rolls nicely into the piece, the number five in this report around securing what you sell. Seriously.
Seriously. I added that. Seriously.
Well, it's a good addition because I think it's important that it's not a joke. You know, security is part of the business. And I'd love to know some of the thinking that went into this, into making this part of the part of the report. I think it's a really valuable item.
Well, I mean, and to the earlier point, there's securing the IP, right? Which you're going to invent. You know, I was a big fan for Corning came up with I thought was a really amazing data classification scheme that they used for a long time. And it was because the CISO had said at the time, we never know when the next Gorilla Glass is going to be found amongst all of our R&D work and our IP work. So they're securing sort of the enterprise and the IP, and then they're securing what you actually go to market with. And again, SolarWinds is going to be the punching bag for this for years to come. But, you know, I've worked with CISOs across broad industries, and only in the last 18 months to 24 months have they even gotten product security under them. Because again, it's often with developers and development teams and separate business units, and it's an afterthought. How can that possibly be if you're going to go to market on trust, an afterthought when it comes to securing products? And again, you'll see now, and just another plug, Laura Ketzel from Forrester is going to be interviewing the CEO, the new CEO for SolarWinds at RSA this year. And we just had a group call about it on Friday, helping her prepare for that and brainstorming that, because it's going to be recorded shortly. It's going to be good. But, you know, again, they're going to be that third slide in every vendor presentation for years to come because they didn't secure what they sold. And then their response to it was dismal. But, you know, I would love to hear what everybody else thinks about this.
It's absolutely a critical area. And I think what's taken us so long to get there is kind of what Dan was talking about in the changing dynamics of the role of the CISO, right? And if we look back at where we came from, we were technical. We were focused on the technical controls. And we realized, oh, wait, we actually have to talk to humans. Okay, well, now we'll learn those skills and we'll start having those conversations. And it's starting to pivot. And as we build those relationships, certainly, you know, it's got to continue to broaden that we're not thinking about, all right, well, I'm just protecting within these four walls. All right, now what are we producing as a company that matters? What is now going to be sitting in somebody else's environment? Because if something happens there, that erodes trust for the core of what we're doing as a business. So it's certainly kind of a shifting mindset. And actually, I'll draw back and kind of, you know, take a point at Brian, because I think there's also something for the sales side of it, that there's a changing dynamic that they've got to, I don't want to say grow up. Well, I guess I said it technically. So they've got to grow up as well. And I think Brian is a great example about this and has talked about this, that they need to learn to start talking in not sales terms as well, that it's having overall risk objectives of the organization to help have a much broader conversation. So kudos to Brian, because you do a great job of that.
Thanks. For a second there, I was like, man, they're really putting the vendor in the corner today.
Sorry.
No, but the honestly, the reality, even before I came into the security realm and worked in automotive, the supplier was, you were always put in the same position in terms of risk. Like you were, in terms of quality, what affected the manufacturer, right? They only assembled the finished good, right? Put it together. We actually manufacture the part. So when it comes to security and the vendors that are making these software as a service, right? You're selling software in. And during that supply chain, and we talked about this before, Eric and Dan, the expectation that updates are going to come really, really fast, right? The vendor that's doing it slow is kind of perceived as, well, they're just not developing fast enough, or they're not being creative.
What have you done for me this weekly release cycle?
Right. And the faster you push that out, the shorter your beta runs become, right? Before you go general availability, right? Or early availability versus general availability. I really think this goes back to talking about, and you mentioned SolarWinds as the third slide in presentations. That's Takata in the manufacturing.
Ah, okay.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Like airbags blowing up.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And bad things happening. Like, in the size of SolarWinds is very similar to the size of Takata. That airbag system became the go-all for almost every single OEM in the world, right? There wasn't a separate supplier, right? There was maybe one or two. So what happened when that imploded and the investigation kicked off and they realized, okay, some testing had been you know, skewed down to save money. Over the span of 10 or 15 years of buying these things, the only place you could reduce was saying, hey, we keep making the same finished good or widget over and over. There's only so much you can pull out as a cost reduction. Other areas were on quality control and so forth. And things go by the wayside. And SolarWinds was a prime example of everybody using the platform, right? And you're pushing out updates here and there. I won't say you lose sight of it, but it's very similar when I look at what happened to Takata. Everybody talks about that in the manufacturing industry. It's very easy to use that as a prime example of why you don't have a single source for the airbag for every single OE in the world. Because when bad things happen,
concentration risk again.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's very, very bad. So, but I also think pivoting to what Eric said, I think on the vendor side, salespeople do need to have some technical acumen to them. Okay. Not just using the slide to talk to, but to be able to put the slide to the right and actually talk about your product and understand how it works. I think you have to understand what the future of your product is, but don't use roadmap slides. Actually talk about what the future of a digital transformation looks like for your customer and be able to facilitate why your product helps them, right? If you can't do that and you're relying on your engineer and you're talking to things that don't exist, it goes back to the blinking lights and buttons.
Right.
And AI and machine learning are only going to take you so far. To Dan's point, people still have to make decisions. Airplanes were the one of the first to use AI and ML. And there's a great flight that came out of South America flying home. And when one sensor went bad and everything else failed, it took 2 years till they got that flight recorder to actually realize that the people staring at the screens all went into this because they didn't know what to do, right? So you depend on these machine and the machine learning and everything else, but when something bad happens and you have no idea what exclusions you put in place a year or 2 years ago, and you realize that you're actually letting all the bad stuff in, but you don't know, and something's happening, you're like, what do I do?
And for everybody listening, the went into this was blinders on. Okay. Since
this is not right, video, that was a visual. Right.
So I mean, looking at the paper, I think, you know, I'll take one of the headings that's part of that section is embedding product security throughout the organization. Mm-hmm. And I'll say that the key to that, and it kind of pertains to Brian, what you were talking about, the key to building relationships is listening, right? And listening to what are the actual problems, what is it the organization needs help with? And that is overarching, helping build a culture of security and helping change that mindset that security is not something that just belongs to this little vertical. Because let's be honest, if security only falls within the security vertical, we're going to fail. It's got to be integrated throughout the organization, with the organization understanding their part and how they have a major role to play. And then you start creating those inroads, and there is going to be a learning curve for us. You know, I think SolarWinds was developing software. You know, if I look at my history, software development's kind of in my wheelhouse. I understand that. Transition to that, where I'm at now, we produce physical products, which we're talking about engineering, not necessarily in my wheelhouse. Brian, certainly within yours, but it's listening, understanding, learning, and being willing to learn and make that pivot to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, and you know, we wrote something last year, and we did a workshop on this actually when I was still on the Security Risk Council around developer security champions. So my colleague Sandy Cariello wrote this report. And again, this is the relationship piece, right? This is, you know, if you cannot put in a product security engineer, you should at least be creating these folks. And we interviewed people from all different kinds of companies that had these developer security champions in there, and they are developers, right? And they have a curiosity, right? And they're interested in security. So this is something that you can reward. And it's a person that can actually be that liaison and be embedded into those teams, because you can't be everywhere at once. You have to empower people to secure what they sell right from the get-go. And so again, always back to relationships when it comes to security. And these are vital roles that people should think about putting into their development teams as quickly as possible.
Jess, to what extent are we seeing people, organizations take and shift this more publicly, where they're taking this idea of securing what they sell and now using it out and pointing their CISOs out toward customers? And I'm talking, you know, there's this move toward advisory CISOs or sales-based CISOs, which I'm not talking about that necessarily. I'm talking about actually putting the person behind your security out in front of customers.
I don't see it enough. you know, I think it is important. And again, it can't be the theater piece, right? It has to be the actual person responsible for information security for the enterprise and for the products that needs to go out there and talk to customers. I think companies of all walks of life and in all industries should be creating advisory boards. You know, it doesn't just have to be a tech company to create a customer advisory board specifically related to security. So I hope that we see more of that. But right now, I'm not seeing a lot of it. I don't know if you guys are.
Yeah, I only because I've been doing that for probably what, 7-8 years.
You have, yes, for sure. Yeah,
but I mean, so that's why I'm asking. I'm like, am I still alone? Am I still one of the only? But am I still alone in this, or are we seeing more and more people? I mean, I'm seeing more and more sales focused CISOs that are doing, you know, that are talking about, maybe this is just in the security industry, I guess. We're seeing people talking about their delegates, their arm, they are proxies for the security organization for companies that are selling security products. But yeah, I don't see a lot where other companies are doing it, but as more and more deeper discussion happens around those third-party risk discussions, you know, mm-hmm. the sales team, they're not answering those questions. They're bringing them back to their security team to answer. So it almost feels like it's a natural progression. I hope it's a natural progression with the increase in third-party risk management discussions and the hopeful depth of those beyond just do you do this, do you not do this, that will happen more.
I think it is within certain verticals, though. Okay. I think there are some community-based broader conversations and understanding of we're in this together. So yes, you may be a customer or a competitor, but when it comes to security, that's something we need to do together. You know, and I'll draw it back to automotive. Automotive is doing that very well. GM has actually right. driven that. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of tier ones that are on that. If you look, take it broader, a step further, automotive ISAC is starting to bring more of the tier ones, tier twos together to have those conversations. So I think there is a light at the end of the tunnel, if you will. I think there's some good examples of pulling that together. I don't know if it exists in every vertical, but certainly agree that it should.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's really, really intelligent of the automotive community to do that because they realize their competitors, you know, across, you know, from vehicle to vehicle, but from a security standpoint, they all share the same supply chain, right? So if one supplier gets hit with something, let's say it's ransomware, and that supplier shuts down, it could shut down everyone. So and you only have to look to the chip manufacturing right now. That has nothing to do with security. That just has to do with a shortage of chips. The same thing could happen though. One facility gets shut down, it affects everybody. You know, one boat gets caught up in the Suez Canal, and that just affected almost everybody, you know, even outside
of the automotive. It was a meme factory too.
Yeah. And but in that conversation, and I'm not going to go there about just-in-time production, people are talking about it. But think about where the idea of Kubernetes and cloud workloads came from. It came from just-in-time production. So also think, if there was an incident there that happened, is there anything like that that could ever take place up there? The idea of micro-segmentation and using containers is creating a supply chain with 200-plus suppliers so you could change anything on their assembly floor without changing your assembly floor. Your output and throughput is still just-in-time one-piece flow for a finished good at the end of the day. So I say, take it for all the DevOps, security ops people out there. If you're having a conversation, think about the Suez Canal and bring that right back to what you're doing in DevSecOps. Pivoting though to other industries, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's the FSISAC in the banking community.
Financial Services,
yep. ISAC. FSISAC. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Or do they do something similar to what GM and the autos created, where they put together an automotive cybersecurity alliance to have those conversations? Is that what they're doing during that? Because I'm actually going to be in attendance to the virtual one this year. So I'm excited to see what they're doing.
Yeah, between FSISAC and BITS, which is an industry organization, that is a lot of what the financial services industry. I was part of FSISAC when it was first getting started back in the early 2000s in my banking days. And yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing that, you know, trying to bring common levels of understanding of controls of information sharing across the industry.
Yeah, my husband leads security for a law firm, and he's part of LSISAT, which is the same thing, right? So these are important organizations for information sharing. But, you know, I don't know if there's enough still going on. I think right. It's peer-to-peer sharing is still not, not as popular as it should be, right? I think people, there are these organizations, but I think cross industry, which is what I love about the Security and Risk Council, was you're learning from people outside of your industry where you can actually think about, well, if this worked in healthcare, maybe it will work in manufacturing, or, you know, anybody who's heavily regulated can share approaches, I think. And I would like to see more of it. And I hope that these ISACs and ISOs can fill that gap and actually do a little bit more. Hopefully they'll be able to bring people together in person again soon for more information sharing.
Right. Yeah. It's a bit of a mind shift, right? Because we've always been at exclusionary protectionism, right? That we are going through contracts and all of that. We're going to protect ourselves, that if something happens to you, supplier, we're going to wag the finger and hold you accountable for what happened. But if you start to think about, well, what if we instead create more of a relationship? So, you know, looking at talking about the automotive suppliers, that maybe we can, almost like the insurance brokers that have come to the realization that, hey, if we offer services up front, we can lessen the impact of an event headed off, and we're all the better. We have less payout. The same thing with the suppliers, that if we can help out some of those smaller companies that don't have the same resources head off some of those security events, it's a win for them because they don't have the event, but it's a win for us because we don't have the domino effect, the impact for us upstream. Just a little bit of a kind of a reframing and mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I want to go back because another part of this research report was that hit me hard was also something we talk about a lot in this and previous episodes of the Great Security Debate, which is around privacy and monitoring. You know, security, there are those that say that security and privacy are orthogonal to each other, and I think to some extent they are coming together, whether we like it or not. But one of the things that over the past year now, or 14, 15 months, as we've sent more and more people to work from home, there's been this push, and I'm not entirely sure on the source of the push, to do more, to have a bit more greater understanding of how efficient are your employees? How much are your employees doing while they're working from home? Yes, we need to secure the world in which our employees are working from home from an endpoint perspective, from a clean desk perspective and others. But there's this growing, bubbling, are they working? Which maybe is a byproduct of, if I can't see you, I can't manage you, or if I can't see you, you're not working. But juxtapose that with this surveillance culture that is also brewing around. And I appreciate that this was called out. And I think the formal title of the section was Balance Security and Privacy When Tracking Employees. So balancing security and privacy is always an important one. But specifically for this year, Jess, you know, mm-hmm. focusing on this from an employee perspective, I guess I'm elated to see this in here. So any other insights to kick off this part of the conversation?
Yeah, we saw a lot of, you know, we were reading a lot of articles and kind of having a lot of conversations as a group about, you know, companies that were starting to get pretty draconian about monitoring their employees. And I don't know about all of you, but everybody that I work with and I speak to that's a client or a colleague has been working more from home during the pandemic. They've taken their 2-hour commute times, and you're getting 2 hours more out of someone. You know, I eat lunch at my desk every day, you know, and it's probably a bad practice, you know, and actually some companies, I think ones that are thinking about this correctly and are thinking about retention, are saying, hey, go take a break, go outside, take a walk, you know, walk your dog for the love of God, you know, just because it's been a long haul. So it was surprising to see at the end of the year, companies talking about tracking employees, and then vendors kind of coming out and saying, we've got this great solution to monitor productivity. It's like, okay,
and we've turned
you need to
it
think
on
about
by
your
default.
Company culture.
Yeah. And we've turned it on by default, and you have to figure out how to turn it off.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, that's a cultural implication. And that's something that would give me pause as an employee, you know, knowing how hard people work. I've had CISOs say they brought whole call centers home, and that people are there taking calls, being, you know, doing all of that at their dining room table, and they haven't lost a bit of productivity. So right. There's a disconnect as to why this is spinning up. It's almost a solution for a problem that I don't think exists in most cases.
I was gonna interrupt there in a, because I agree with you, Jess. Like the whole eating lunch, like I've had to force myself to try to eat it upstairs, right. But then I'm getting it done in like 20, 30 minutes. And then I'm just right back on the computer. You know, there was a 2 week span where I went for a walk outside and then I got on the bike and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, then I got really busy again. And I needed that time to get caught up on stuff. But I would say, just from a previous life working in manufacturing, that I could look around the room and probably say that there be at least 30% of the people that worked in the environment, but this was also due to culture. All right. So I will agree with you there, that I know right now are probably using 50% of their time at home to do exactly what they were doing in the office. And that's avoiding working. I mean, I can think of one gentleman that when we actually went and tried to find out how much time he spent on the internet and what he was looking at, 63% of his day was spent just shopping online, playing video games and whatnot. You know, he always had an opinion in every meeting, but never really did much. So in part of that was the culture of the environment where we worked and how we worked and who we reported to. So I will agree there. And it's that part of company culture, I believe that, and you can read it in books, you see it firsthand when you've been working in enterprises for a while, that's extremely detrimental. And it goes to that big brother feeling later.
Right. I think so much of the conversation around COVID and pandemic and all of that has centered around pointing out security departments that were not ready to change. We're not ready to get the company to shift to this work home mentality. But I think what's missed in this narrative is how many companies actually going into the pandemic did not know how to track productivity correctly. And we've talked about this before, that your metrics for tracking productivity, if you're on a manufacturing, it's parts that you're turning out. If you're in a call center, it's how many calls you're taking, how many abandoned calls. Those metrics are there. It doesn't matter if your employee is in the office or at home, because if the metric we're trying to track, and this is where it gets to, you're trying to track time in seat. That is a BS metric.
Yeah, it is.
Means nothing. It is anti-human. I mean, right. It has no bearing on the productivity and what we're gonna, the success of the company. So I think going into this, there's a lot of companies out there that just did not realize that they did not have a good handle on defining what productivity means.
Yeah, and technology can't replace just good management and leadership. Right. If you've got a problem employee, manage them out. Don't put don't invest in a technology that covers everyone and makes them all feel awful when they know they're actually doing their job. Figure out a way to manage out the people that aren't pulling their weight. And that seems like, I feel like that's always abdicated to technology. You know, figure it out, work with HR, do the right things. And manage the bad apples out, you know? Technology is not that solution. So I hate to see people's privacy being compromised as a result of just not stepping up for leadership.
Now, about 4 or 5 months ago, there was an interesting change in the way that this was talked about. 6 months into this, we saw a lot of people hitting the wall. You know, the people were working too hard, working too much, not getting out of their chairs, myself included. I actually had Brian, when you described your work, you know, you worked out for the first couple of weeks and then work took over and I never,
yeah,
same exact thing. I never left this chair. But the focus and I can't tell if this was genuine or if this was really great marketing was to focus on mental health. On using these technologies to help people when they needed to know when they needed to walk away, which I applaud. I think it's a phenomenal, it is exactly something that we as managers need to be cognizant of, that we're not overworking, that if we're not, you know, we're not seeing if a person is sitting in that chair for 12 hours a day instead of just six, mm-hmm. or never walking away. And some of those signals can be gained through this type of analysis, but at the same time, it feels like it was just a new front end on an old trope that wasn't, you know, it still didn't take into account the fact that you are monitoring your employees.
Right.
In order to do this, you are monitoring your employees. And what's preventing managers who want to win, who want to do more, who want, from using this information for the wrong purposes rather than the right purposes. And I really, and in security, we all want to do the right thing and we want to keep doing it. So we're going to tend toward using it to do even more. And then, the privacy and protection portion of our brains wonders what other people will do with it.
Yeah. Just again, it comes down to, what comes down to messaging. And one of my favorite CISOs besides yourselves here, Donna Ross at Radiant Group, led by example. She's like, I have to take a day off. I'm taking a day off so my team can see that it's okay to take a day off in the middle of this pandemic. I'm taking a day off and I'm not going anywhere because I can't, but I'm taking the day. And I thought that was a great message. And again, it's leading by example. It's not using technology. It's actually using leadership to say, here's how you should model your behavior. And I thought that was really cool and a really good message to send to a security team that had been working so hard since moving everybody, home. So leadership, man.
Yeah, totally.
I was going to throw in there, one of the things you guys were, I won't say alluding to or talking to, but was feeling safe, right? Like to be able to communicate to your management that you do feel burned out, right? If you haven't created an environment where somebody feels safe telling you that, they're not going to tell you that. And then if you put something in place to monitor them, then they don't feel safe at all.
Right.
Right. Now they feel compelled to work harder, talk about it less. I think it goes against when you say the safe health and everything else. There was something that someone shared online recently. I put it up in the chat, and it said, only 10% of people are natural leaders. The rest of us have to work on developing these three qualities. And number two, one, two, three was great leaders leverage team diversity by creating safe environments where everyone feels comfortable. And that's not just being able to share that you're overworked or that you're stressed, et cetera. That's also being able to share to your leader when you disagree with something and feel safe being able to disagree. And I think that becomes really important when we're having this conversation about balancing security and privacy when tracking employees. People need to feel safe to be able to disagree with that and share that and know that management's going to take that into mind. So I push back on the people that are working in those environments to push back and ask why it's needed. Like what type of metric are you going to get out of that? And what's the gain versus the net loss?
Right.
And the net loss is probably going to be much greater than what you believe the gain's going to be.
It comes back to the project management question. What are you trying to solve? What are the outcomes that you're looking to create? As it pertains to privacy, I think we got to keep in mind, just because we can doesn't mean we should, right? Just because technology exists or we should track this. I mean, you've got to think about the long-term ramifications and this whole big brother mentality, track everything. It's a slippery slope. It's dangerous.
Yeah. And I think if you look at the recommendations there, all of it's about process and awareness messaging, because a lot of what would be considered insider threat is kind of just misuse and accidental data loss. And so people are home and they have maybe companies didn't give them something to go home with, like a laptop, and they've got a workstation, or they're sharing a computer, all those things. Yeah, you don't need to monitor and track for it. You need to message, here's what you shouldn't be doing. And people had to write whole new policies, right? When this first happened, I remember everybody saying, oh God, everybody's got an Alexa in their room, and that's not great. And or your kids are grabbing the laptop. And there was so many policies that didn't exist that had to be written. And I think that's an important piece, right? Telling people, okay, this is a different environment. Here's what you need to be aware of. But it doesn't mean you need to be tracking, because again, that goes to productivity, not insider threat, malicious or otherwise. That's just productivity.
Dan, on one final note, and Jess, I think you're going to love this one, to bring it back to another automotive analogy.
I'm here for it. I'm Connecticut Yankee in Michigan podcast. I'm all about it.
So when you look at the highest quality vehicles out there, the ones that have the lowest number of warranty, the vehicle or the manufacturer that falls up at the top of the list most regularly is Lexus. And most people believe that they put in probably the most AI and ML at the end of their line for looking for bad quality parts. And what most people don't realize is there are a lot of human people at the end of that line looking for things. Because no matter how many different pokey oaks you put in place on the line and quality controls and everything else, things still get through. And the same is in security and the same in working with people. You can put ways to monitor them, et cetera. But at the end of the day, teaching, listening, hearing, and allowing them to perform will give you better quality output. Same thing with your product that you're using, understanding how to use it, the controls, what you're trying to solve. So it really comes down to people. And being human is not just a soft skill. It's a skill, right? Being able to communicate with each other. So on that, I really love the piece. It was a great write-up. And I think there's some great pointers to take away from today's conversation.
And Brian, to build on that and keep me honest here, empowerment was also a key in their philosophy in the quality. Because if I recall correctly, as you looked at their lines when they're producing cars, that they introduced, it was like a rope that anybody could pull at any point that would shut down the line if they saw anything that wasn't going correctly. So they empowered their employees to raise their hand if something was out of line and needed to be fixed.
And dare I say that comes down to building good relationships within the organization, between security and across the organization, and giving people that comfort that they're, you know, I mentioned in the chat, and we mentioned a few times here, that the one metric that I use in organizations is not about how many things were blocked or how mean time to anything. It's about what is the sentiment of information security and privacy throughout the organization. Mm-hmm. And do people culturally feel comfortable walking into my office or any team member on the security team and say, I have a question about security or I have a concern. And that, to me, I think sets everything else up.
Yeah.
And it comes back to relationships, and all of these items in the paper are pivoted on. None of them can happen if we don't have good relationships with the organization.
Yeah, it really comes back down to that. This conversation sort of hit that home. Very cool.
Nice. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. I could go on for hours and hours on this. Jess Byrne, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you.
Am I your first guest?
You are our first guest.
That's awesome.
Brian, Eric, thanks again for another great security debate. If you're interested in providing feedback to us, we have an email address, feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. And we have a website, greatsecuritydebate.net. Our Twitter is @securitydebate. And we want to hear from you. You know, we want your feedback. We want your ideas. We want your thoughts. We would love to know if you have guests who would like to be on the show. If you have topic ideas, we would love to hear those. If you have ways that we can do this better and provide even more value, please send those as well. You can subscribe in your favorite podcast app. We look forward to seeing you on the next Great Security Debate.